Hi, and welcome. My name is Henrik. You're listening to Red Eyes Radio. Thank you for tuning in today. Our website, redeyescreations.com, and for our subscribers, redeyesmembers.com. Today we're talking with Patrick Henningsen from 21stcenturywire.com. He's back with us on the program to discuss the situation in Syria that is escalating. We're also going to talk about NSA surveillance, Snowden, and the chase going on in the media right now. All right, welcome back, Patrick. Good to talk to you again so soon. I hope you've been hanging onto your hat here in the last few weeks, because a lot of things has been going on. It's just incredible. It comes and goes in these waves, but I think we're definitely in one right now with all the geopolitical games that are ongoing. What do you make of it, Patrick?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on. I mean, just from where I'm sitting right now, I'm in the Middle East, so this situation is flaring up really right now, especially this week here in Lebanon. And, of course, this has everything to do with what's happening next door in Syria. And that whole situation has taken some interesting turns in the last few months. The big game changer with Syria came at the end of April, when Hezbollah announced that it was sending troops and paramilitary support for the Assad government to do sort of urban warfare and do house-to-house sort of stuff. And, of course, that it's believed by many that that's changed the tide in the Syrian conflict. And right now, the Syrian army has ousted the insurgency from some of the border towns along Lebanon, and they're working their way through other regions right now. So, according to one gentleman, Lebanese gentleman I spoke to last week, in those certain words, he said that they're kicking ass right now. Hmm. And of course, this comes at a time when, all of a sudden, as this is happening, this tremendous amount of pressure being put on Hezbollah within Lebanon from the various political factions and sectarian factions, and radical Sunni clerics are calling for their gunmen to attack government soldiers. So that what they're doing is trying to isolate Hezbollah, threaten a civil war, and the end result is try to isolate Hezbollah. And the people who have an interest in this, first and foremost, are Israel, because Hezbollah is the protector of the South Lebanese border, essentially, and also the United States and Britain and France would like to see this group gone, because it's one of the things that has given Lebanon a little bit of a bargaining chip, but it's also been a handicap politically within the country, because Hezbollah has its share of enemies, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
There is a sectarian issue between certain Sunnis and Shiites, and then the Christians are sort of in the middle, not wanting to see a repeat of the civil war here. But the situation in Lebanon is very much tied to the situation in Syria. And so Obama's come out last week and all of a sudden says that, he sees evidence of chemical weapons. I can't show you that evidence, but we have evidence. And so the Assad government has crossed that red line. They're using chemical weapons. So now we need intervention, beginning with arming the rebels above the table. They've been doing it under the table, of course, for almost a year now.
Yeah.
Now they want to do it over the table officially. And they've allocated hundreds of millions of dollars for this project. And the main pressure for this operation in Syria is, funny enough, although John McCain has flown over to Turkey and crossed the border into Syria to meet with Al-Qaeda, that was in the news, his friends Al-Qaeda in Aleppo, very bizarre political career this man's had. But it may seem like the U.S. is the main driver. The main driver is Britain, France, and the European NATO gang. They are the main drivers for this effort in Syria. They've, the U.S. is there to provide backup. And, of course, the big quiet player in this whole Syrian situation is Israel. They're staying very quiet, but, of course, they've run a few major airstrikes into Syria. Unprovoked, of course. So Israel clearly has an interest, and I believe their interest is geographical, and also to have more of a radical Syria in terms of the sectarian Islamic Syria benefits Israel in the short term, because it one, Israel can defend its borders against anybody. That's not an issue. They've got the place fully locked down. But what Israel needs is a distraction away from any talk about peace or any justice with Palestine. They want to kick that can further down the road, and that's always been a goal of Israel. The other goal is to expand its land territory. So by toppling the Assad regime, Israel will then have option on the Golan Heights, which I believe they'll take. And also, it'll give them, if Hezbollah is somehow neutralized in this process, it'll give them leverage in South Lebanon. But first and foremost, what it does is it hamstrings Iran's best ally in this part of the Middle East, which is Syria, and number two, Hezbollah, which is Hezbollah is a state within a state. It's a Shiite community within Lebanon. It has paramilitary aspects left over from the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon. And they've gone into politics officially, much like, you know, Sinn Féin has in Northern Ireland. They're wanting to, the U.S. and the European Union and Israel want to reverse that. They want to isolate them. And even the United Arab Emirates has announced it's going to be deporting, revoking citizenship or residency for certain Shiite people that are even born there in Dubai. There's Shiite pockets all over the Middle East, and I pointed this out over a year ago on Russia Today, and I said this will be very difficult to contain if there is ever an attack on Iran, because you have these Shiite pockets in Bahrain, you have them in Saudi, you have them in the Emirates, you have them in Iraq, you have them in Lebanon, Syria. So they'll be very difficult to contain, and the first thing you'd want to do is you'd want to demonize them and create a refugee situation where they'd be all moving back to Iran or something like that. So it's all part of the balkanization of the Middle East and achieving balkanization through an arc of conflict. And through this arc of conflict, you have opportunities for reconstruction projects with major corporations, NGOs, and then to revamp the banking system eventually. Yep. And bring in Starbucks, you know, and McDonald's to every corner in Damascus, and have British and American companies and Saudi companies taking the lion's share of that economy.
So this, Patrick, is something that most people don't understand in the way that they're using it in the short term and then in the long term, because this would be, of course, antithetical to some of the ideas that people might think about this in the geopolitical sense, that why would they want to try to use, radicalized Islamic groups and everything else to try to reform the country? But even on a long-term basis then, or a little bit more, maybe not in the full extent that you were talking about in terms of getting in the Starbucks and the McDonald's, but if we back up a little bit from that, one of the long-term plans, I guess, is to radicalize maybe Syria enough to make it another country being viable, basically for the West to go in and permanently quote-unquote, liberate the country from these, wicked groups. Yeah. Is that the plan in the long term, do you think?
Yeah, it does give a justification for military occupation. It also gives a justification for selling arms to whoever the partners are for keeping law and order in that country for the next decade or 15 or 20 years. And a billion-dollar industry that you can't deny is the NGO industry and some of the NGOs that are buttressed by the United Nations. There's people, huge thousands of people's careers feeding off this. And of course, this is an opportunistic industry that feeds off of war-torn areas. So you can't deny the existence of this. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. And on the whole, they do very little, produce very little anyway. They talk a lot and they produce a lot of reports.
Yeah.
But as far as work on the ground, very little. USAID, USAID is a big one. It's called an NGO, but it's anything but. It's a government organization based out of Washington that's joined at the hip with the State Department. And they'll go into countries like Iraq or Lebanon or, the war-torn Egypt or whatever, and they'll throw money around. And, of course, they'll be giving contracts to local businesses. So it's a way of buying political patronage, pro-U.S. patronage, very, very cheaply, in fact. And for various programs from agriculture to industry, to education, to infrastructural projects. And this is how they do it. It's kind of like how the Romans did it, if you want to get really simple about it.
Yeah.
They come in with the Roman coinage and the Roman projects after the war, and so that the barbarian hordes are, you know, not too upset about what happened. That's kind of the system that they've got there. Now, with regard to Syria, our leaders in the West will say it's about liberating the Syrian people from a despotic dictator named Bashar al-Assad, who's slaughtering his own people. Of course, we heard that with Libya as well, and there was very little slaughtering of his own people being done by Gaddafi, and I would imagine the same is true here in Syria. So, what it is, it's a great rhetoric, and it provides the headlines, and it provides the, it provides the justification for this kind of ramping up these big projects, military projects. So Obama went on national TV and he quoted numbers and he said Bashar al-Assad's killed 100,000 people. Of course, that's a complete lie. The President of the United States had to go on national TV and lie, or at least he's being briefed by people who are making him lie. Either way, it's not been seen.
Yeah.
And so, they're counting just about anything that's died in Syria in the last 2 years as being innocent protesters killed by Bashar al-Assad. And then, of course, he's inflating the refugee numbers as well in Jordan, in places like this, and saying it's a humanitarian crisis. And he's inflating the chemical weapons case. Everything's inflated. And what's happened is they've really, really mismanaged their operation. They thought it was going to be done and dusted by last August. They really did. And that's how good the CIA is with their intelligence and when they're hyping up their politicians with all these briefings. We're doing really well. This Aleppo's fallen and we'll have the airport by the end of August and it's pretty much over then. And blah, blah, blah. And of course, anything but, right?
Yeah.
And the opposite's happened. Their jihadist foreign mercenary soldier armies are being routed out of the country. And the only thing that's keeping them alive, really, is Saudi Arabia and Qatar are paying the salaries of every single one of these fighters. So it's a business. You know, these people won't be coming from, they're coming from Pakistan, Chechnya, Egypt, Tunisia, Turkey, wherever. They're not coming for free. They're not coming for the adventure. They're coming because they've got nothing else to do, and someone's offering them $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month. That's why they're coming. And that's well documented, the payrolls. Well documented.
Wow.
And I imagine Qatar and Saudi are picking up the majority of those payrolls. And then the U.S. and Europe, through the proxies of supplying the arms, shipping them in through Turkey and through Jordan. And so, of course, anything that happens in Jordan, Israel knows about. If Israel had any security concerns about destabilization of Syria, they wouldn't have allowed 700 tons or 7,000 tons, I believe, of heavy armory and weaponry to be airlifted from Croatia into Jordan and then transferred over the border with the help of U.S. military and British special technicians, military technicians.
Wow.
who are also training the rebels on Jordanian soil. So if Israel really had an issue with the destabilization of Syria, they wouldn't be allowing Jordan to be a staging ground for this so-called civil war in Syria.
So they have everything under control, but for the media, for the rest of the international world, it seems like complete chaos, of course, and something needs to be done about it tomorrow.
Yeah. Time's running out. These were peaceful demonstrators who were killed by President Assad back when the Arab Spring started, which Obama said on TV, and that's a lie. The whole destabilization and the uprising in Syria, the main bits of it in Homs was attack. Some unknown people stabbed a few police officers to death during a pro-Assad rally. And also there were snipers on rooftops shooting civilians, and no one knew where these snipers came from. And those were the reports that came immediately at the beginning of all this 2 years ago. And so this is what wasn't part of the Arab Spring. And the Arab Spring didn't happen, as far as I'm concerned, in the way that it's been kind of
portrayed, you know, in the media.
Yeah, the mythology of the Arab Spring in the media didn't happen as it was. It was engineered in advance of it offshore by some very well-funded pro-democracy think tanks and action groups like Opdoor and Canvas out of Belgrade, with George Soros funding, Tides Foundation connected, National Endowment from Democracy, Open Society Institute, U.S. State Department linked, all of these. And they were taking Tunisians, Egyptians, people off out of the country for workshops, training them on this whole Twitter revolution thing, and then putting them back in the country. And of course, it magically happened at that time, and the media reported it as some sort of kumbaya moment. And just like they did with the Occupy movement, which again was seeded from partially George Soros-funded organization out of Vancouver called Adbusters.
That's right. Yeah,
it was very, very well coordinated from the beginning. So, and what they, you know, and like all these things, they might be, there'll be aspects of a genuine movement. I mean, there are real protesters in Egypt. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
The government was cracking heads. You know, 1,500 people died. You know, they're running people over. I saw the film of it. It's really horrible. But the Twitter revolution, the kind of English-speaking banners, all that heavily coordinated U.S. media-targeted stuff, it was all engineered, and most of it was done offshore.
See, there's so many people that don't get this, and it's such an important point. You know, like, you know, Google has been part of this with their, you know, kind of 2.0 color revolution. They call it the revolution factory, you know?
Big time, Google, yes.
Absolutely, yes. Amazing, you know, how they managed to do this. See, I've speculated for a while, not that it might be necessary, but I wonder, in the backdrop of all this, Patrick, what kind of algorithms they use, what type of node points in terms of the profiles that are connected with a lot of people on the social networks, who actually is behind those profiles and who actually is coordinating it. Because in some regards, it almost seems like a, I don't know what to call it, a military strategy in the way that people are sent out by communicating over social networks. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, it's a digital revolution, and it is run like a military operation. Definitely, you've got customized algorithms for trending words and topics, and utilizing Twitter heavily in this as well. So it is a business. It's a business. It's a revolution business. These people, firms are getting paid, and of course, Google is essential in this, and their involvement in the color revolutions and Google's kind of, you know, wonderful global youth political movement that it's been backing all around the world in different workshops and different events, and they're central to it. Of course, Google runs the backbone of the internet, okay, essentially. Everything runs through Google now.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna run something, you want it to be impactful, and you want the terms to trend immediately, and you want the crowd to be directed and led down the right path, on the digital path anyway, Google's going to play a central role in that.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, movements.org, another one of these NGO organizations that are well in with all this as well. And it's this, what people need to understand is that this is an continuation of the neocons agenda, which is actually very, very closely aligned, as Lou Rockwell and others have pointed out, with Trotskyism, which is about the exportation of the revolution, just as you said, or in this case, they call it democracy, and this is a way of life, a whole corporate structure around this that is being, exported to the rest of the world, basically. And what we're seeing now, despite people believing that this is an internal struggle within the country, or in the terms of Libya and Egypt and everything else, this is something that's being run externally. And again, people don't get this. They don't understand this point.
Sure. They've tried it in Iran and in one of the previous elections, the color revolution. I think they gave it the green color, and it failed miserably. And also they've tried it in Russia during the last election. Total failure. And then still the U.S. media went and said that the Russian election was rigged. Every single U.S. network and the BBC as well, I believe, chimed in on that. And, of course, you looked at the exit polls, and they were pretty much the same as the final voting results. So, I mean, most of the people voted for Vladimir Putin, obviously. But in the Ukraine and Georgia, these are former Soviet satellite republics who became independent. There were two color revolutions in those countries, and I believe it was the Orange Revolution in Georgia. No, in the Ukraine.
There was the Rose Revolution, I think, in Georgia, and Ukraine was orange.
Those were the predecessors to the Arab Spring. That's where they really tested out their mettle in terms of, you know, how to sort of perfect this operation. Of course, look at what came in power in Georgia. They basically parachuted in a New York lawyer, Ivy League lawyer, from New York law firm, American, who's of Georgian descent to run the country. And he's no fan of civil liberties, let me tell you, and nearly started a war with Russia in August 2008. So he's also drafted in all his top military advisors or have dual Israeli citizenship, and he's got something like, I don't know, 50 or 60 high-level U.S. military advisors within his military structure, the tiny little country of Georgia, right?
Yeah.
So he came in on the color revolution as well. But what, essentially what it is for the public, the color revolution is like this. It's like society sees itself in a birdcage, and then the color revolution comes and it opens the birdcage door, and everybody herds out with banners and face painted, and everyone's really ecstatic and out in the street and doing the Occupy thing, and then they've already got another birdcage built for them, which is a slightly bigger one. Slightly wider birdcage with more space in it. And they don't even notice that they've gone into a new birdcage, although it's a little bit bigger because of the internet. Okay, but essentially they're in the same birdcage. That's exactly, look at Egypt. You know, nothing really has changed in Egypt other than the country's inching its way towards a civil war right now. I predict that that country will descend into a civil war within 12 months.
Wow. I wanted to mention to you here, I think, very important, or it might be a minor connection at first, but one of the people that were actually funding behind the Orange Revolution was Boris Berezovsky, former, you know, oligarch. He was the one who put Putin in place pretty much, and then the switch happened where Putin basically threw out all of these guys. And I think that, you know, Berezovsky worked with, I think it was a Goldfarb, I don't know if it was Alex Goldfarb or whatever, and they showed even in this BBC documentary called Russian Godfathers, I mentioned this before, but in that they show how they basically with, the, you know, not that much money really, but, you know, with banners and some balloons and a band on the square, you know, there in Ukraine and everything, basically managed to start this whole, you know, movement. And of course they've been working vehemently on the press as well at the same time. But it just showed, and this is so amazing, it's blatantly open there in the BBC documentary, how simple it is to start a quote-unquote grassroots movement for, you know, change or towards a certain direction. Absolutely astonishing.
Sure. You have the banners printed up in English in advance. All of a sudden, in Iran, it was amazing. I think it was 2006. I'm not sure what year it was, but 2008, actually. And all these English banners, you know, perfect grammar and everything, came out, and all the banners in the crowd for the color revolution were, there was nothing in Farsi, it was all in English. So clearly the target was a Western audience to get some sort of mandate, sympathy mandate, saying that this is the general will of the people here, because look at all the crowds, look at all the beautiful colored banners in English, and the sort of people they select to do spots to camera, and so forth. And it all contributes to give a kind of an impression to Western people that, you know, the tide of democracy is moving its way into the various corners of the despotic parts of Central Asia and the Middle East, and soon they're going to be just like us, have, you know, neoliberal economies like us. All the Nordic model might spread down to the Middle East. It's all wonderful, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I know.
They want to train us to think like that, so they see that as progress, okay? But in reality, there's a whole other agenda under the surface, and it has nothing to do with any of that.
That's right, absolutely. Do you have any insights in terms of what happened to Boris Berezovsky, or if you speculate that he was picked off? You know, he died in London there, and might be some foul play by the Russians. Did you ever look into that or hear about that, Patrick?
there's a lot of speculation. I mean, Boris was not without his share of enemies. Let's put it that way. And then you had the Litvinenko man who was allegedly, after it's been revealed, he was a double agent for MI5 and the FSB, who died from a plutonium injection at a sushi restaurant in Mayfair. So, you know, that was intricately connected with the Boris situation there. But yes, there was definitely a power struggle in Russia in the 90s, and a lot of wealth was accumulated by a few individuals and concentrated into the hands of a few families very quickly after the Iron Curtain fell. And there was turf wars, and there are political turf wars, and of course, the biggest thing is, you know, never in history have you seen that many billionaires created overnight. It's not without its ripple effects. And also the U.S. banks and the U.S. Kind of spy operations and all the rest of it, and the corporations and the neoliberal economic planners were in there from the beginning when Boris Yeltsin took the reins of power. And Russia had hyperinflation at that time. And of course, the West was looking to sort of get pieces of things easily in exchange for their so-called help. And they were soon kicked out by the sort of a lot of organized crime aspects of what was going on in Russia. But a huge power shift. A lot of Russians fled the country, including Berezovsky, Roman Abramovich, some of these so-called oligarchs leaving, ending up in New York. Many in London, Cyprus, and Dubai.
Many of them dual citizenship with Israel, going back and forth as well.
Yes, that too. So, you know, very interesting story. I would love someone to do an anthology or a book on this subject. It would be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it's an ongoing game for sure. Now, I do want to pick up here with everything in the geopolitical game, of course, ties in with each other, but I do want to so we're kind of in the halfway point here for the first segment. I do want to switch over focus a little bit, and we can return to Syria later for sure. But we have to talk about Edward Snowden, NSA, PRISM, the whole circus basically that's been going on now for what, over a week? Is it more? I mean, this is just I have my reservations in terms of how it's being played in the media. Despite this, of course, I think that there's definitely, it's a strand of genuine, super important information being revealed here, but we can definitely a bit later talk about how this is used in the media for the, you know, kind of catch me if you can kind of game that we're watching right now. I think the latest has been coming in as we're doing this recording is basically that he basically is confirmed to be in Moscow, I think, at the airport right now and entering into Russia. But what do you make of the whole Snowden story, and how did you approach it as it began to unfolding, Patrick?
When I first heard this story, I thought, wow, this seems like a big story. But the thing that made me very skeptical from the beginning was that The Guardian in London is the one who got this information. And we were led to believe, the public anyway, were led to believe that Ed Snowden went to a British newspaper because, quote, he said that no U.S. media outlet would publish it, because obviously there's a chilling effect on the press in America right now. So, you know, I went along with that narrative for the first day or two, but then I also wondered to myself, you know, I'm very skeptical of certain high-level whistleblowers these days, because if you look at, let's start with Julian Assange, okay?
Yeah.
He's not actually a whistleblower, he's a publisher, but we'll call him a whistleblower for this, you know, story. Now, he's the stuff that WikiLeaks dumped, that massive document dump, the one that apparently got Julian Assange in hot water. Well, for anybody that had been following the news, or at least on the alternative media, or, you know, anything other than the major networks, that nothing in there came as any sort of shock. Very little there was of any, you know, there was no big revelation, let's say.
Yeah.
There was a lot of interesting details in terms of the Stratfor emails and some of that sort of stuff. Stratfor is a private intelligence gathering firm based in Austin, Texas, that's essentially a CIA front. It allows the CIA to work on U.S. soil unofficially. What Stratfor does is they collect the intelligence and then they sell it to the CIA. And so it's kind of a business, it's like outsourcing on domestic soil, basically. Mm-hmm. And Stratford also has a media arm called Parker Media, and who serves some of the public relations duties of that operation. But that was in the WikiLeaks document dump. Okay, so Assange is in hot water for what? U.S. soldiers shooting up innocent civilians in Iraq? Yes, maybe there was a film of it, but, I mean, it's nothing new if you've been following the Iraq war from the beginning.
That's right.
And again, we come to Bradley Manning, this document dump. The Bradley Manning situation is connected with WikiLeaks. Now, again, there's nothing in the Bradley Manning document dumps that was anything of a serious revelation. But both of these characters have been sort of vilified, have been treated with a heavy hand by the state, and have probably deterred many people from coming forward with things they know because of what's happened to them. Their mistreatment has been very well publicized. And here we have Ed Snowden, who's come out to say that he could basically access anything down a thread, any phone records, and if he wanted to look into something, he could, and he had all that power there. As a ex-CIA analyst, remember, this Mr. Snowden, ex-CIA employee working for the NSA in a bunker in Hawaii. Very interesting profile, 29 years old. And it makes me wonder, you know, how do you go from being a CIA analyst to an ex-CIA analyst working for the NSA? And also it makes me question, there's nothing new in Edward Snowden's revelations. I mean, the Echelon program goes all the way back to George Bush Sr., 1988, whereby the U.S. Created the Echelon program, an upper echelon, and they couldn't do it legally on U.S. soil, so they built it and put it in North Yorkshire in the British Isles, and then had the information routed back to the NSA. Totally illegal, but legal in terms of, you know, what passes for legal in Washington these days. But so that was an old system that was gathering all sorts of information. They could target and collect just about anything they wanted. And so the internet's come, and there's this sort of different way of processing that information and keeping it archived, storing it, and then being able to call on it when you want to sort of profile a certain person, be it a whistleblower, a journalist, or some dissenter. Very little probably has to do with actually apprehending terrorists. Most of the, I mean, I don't want to get into that story. Most of the terror operations they've thwarted in the U.S. have been FBI-designed informants.
That's right. Yep.
Operations. So there's not a lot of real terrorism going on in the world.
No.
But there's hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, have been spent in the last 20 years to catch so-called terrorists. And, of course, that's invaded into our personal privacy as citizens in the so-called free world. You know, and the Edward Snowden thing, I think my guess is that there might be a political motivation behind this. I mean, I think Snowden, my personal opinion, is he's an asset. He's an active asset in the field, and they activated him. And whether he's a useful idiot who's going along with it or he actually knows what he's doing in terms of the deception of it is anyone's guess. But there is definitely a problem with Syria, and this is where all eyes come back to Syria. The timing of the Snowden event was a huge embarrassment for the Obama administration, broken by a British newspaper. So the British and the French are much more gung-ho about Syria than Washington is right now. So this could have been a way to put pressure on the Americans about Syria for Obama to make a commitment. Of course, who would be behind that sort of an effort would be the British and the French. And who's behind the British and the French? Well, the Israelis are behind the British and the French. The Israelis dictate foreign policy for all those countries as well as the United States. So, but Israel is wanting to stay very quiet about their involvement and their interests in Syria, as is Saudi Arabia. But of course, those two countries, both Israel and Saudi Arabia, are pivotally involved in what's happening in Syria. The timing of the Snowden affair, I don't believe in coincidences, Henrik. So I'm looking at the timing of this, and I'm going, okay, what have they achieved now? They've achieved, now it's okay for whistleblowers don't have any international refuge, okay? Except for maybe one, maybe two countries where they can go to in the world, like Cuba or North Korea, okay? That's number one. So no international whistleblowers. Edward Snowden's provided the Trojan horse for that. And also, it's you know, if you have the access, Ed Snowden says he has, there's a lot bigger fish that you could be pulling out of the pond. Like take 9/11, for instance. What do you think is Ed Snowden could access with his access about 9/11?
Yeah. I see what you mean.
Just about anything he wanted, probably, if the NSA spying backbone is that powerful.
It's if I put it this way, what has been revealed so far is kind of like a no shit kind of thing. You know, it's like, I mean, we know about the massive data center that the NSA has built up in Utah, in Bluffdale, you know, or, you know, for storage purposes. And they have that huge headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. It's like 3 million square feet. It's like 18,000 parking spaces around this, you know, black cube right there. They have been obviously working on this for a long time. And the wiretapping scandal, if you will, in the, you know, UK as well, of course, but the US is nothing new either. So let's take that a step further and think about, okay, so what is the intention and the purpose of that? Because what really has been shown in a way so far with PRISM and everything is, of course, that the American people is illegally being listened in on. That's the thing. So how is this being used in the bigger picture? Is it a psychological warfare that they want people to know that they are being listened to and that they are being watched? Or is it as you're kind of suggesting it, that this, in a way, it's kind of like a cover-up. Like, if you want to focus on a leak or a scandal, okay, let's prematurely release it and make it something which is a bit more trivial, perhaps, than something that could really have been dug out in terms of important information. Not that this isn't important, of course, that people are being spied on, but the deeper analysis of this, Patrick, what do you think?
Well, it serves a lot of different purposes. I mean, immediately you have to look at, there's a lot of good articles on 21st Century Wire, our website right now today. One of them is Moody's downgraded 9 major Hong Kong banks over the week. Okay, now that's kind of if you look at World War One and what led up to World War One and World War Two, there was a bit of a global financial warfare going on at that time. Leading up to those two massive wars. And we're seeing some of the same things happen today. So the interests in Hong Kong, the really wealthy interests, are directly connected with Great Britain, and Moody's is controlled by the United States. So again, if it's tit for tat, the British used Snowden to embarrass Obama over the NSA, then the Americans use Moody's to downgrade major Hong Kong banks, 9 of them, in fact. Downgrade their credit ratings and change the whole bond valuations and everything, and putting China in a precarious investment position in the short term. So you look at that situation, you look at the situation with regards to a lot of rhetoric before the Snowden affair about the Chinese cyber warfare, Chinese hackers infiltrating the United States, when if you look at all the real hardcore reporting and studies, it shows that the U.S. is hacking China much more than China is hacking the U.S. But the U.S. is trying to paint it as the Chinese government have their army of hackers targeting U.S. intellectual property, and they're trying to steal the next iPhone design. These are Obama's words himself, actually, which I think is kind of disingenuous at best, and that's for public consumption. That is the kind of black and white protagonist-antagonist narrative that the government has used to give to the public for consumption. But there's not a whole lot of truth in that narrative as it stands as a good versus bad narrative. The real truth of the matter is much more complex than that. The U.S. Are much more aggressive If you look at the U.S. foreign policy, it's the most aggressive in the world, and that's backed by the British, by the way.
Yeah.
But if you think there's going to be any cyber warfare going on, you better be sure that the most aggressive countries militarily are also the most aggressive and well-resourced on the cyber warfare front. In fact, you know, the U.S. will, you know, be paying hackers in China and Iran even to do their hacking for them. So when the attacks come, it looks like they come from China and Iran. Okay.
Yeah.
My email account was hacked and I traced it back to an Iranian source. And I've never written anything bad about Iran in the last couple of years. So there'll be no reason for the Iranian government to target my website or my email account. So that's clearly looks like to me was a proxy, and a lot of other reports, similar reports as well, coming out of China, coming out of Iran. So money talks at the end of the day, you know. So mm-hmm. if you have a talented, skilled hacker and someone says, oh, I'm going to send you, a few thousand a month on PayPal for the next year, you're probably going to be on the case. So, back to the Snowden affair. Yes, to me, it's not what it appears to be. I think Snowden's a limited hangout. He's given some of a revelation, but nothing of significance, really. And if you look at the real story, this could be a tit for tat. The British and the Europeans pushing America to act in Syria to give the backup they need. Because right now the Syrian project is going way behind schedule. They're failing miserably. They're losing that war, that guerrilla proxy war right now. And Obama's had to come out in public now and say, you know, he's taking a side and he's doing the whole Bush weapons of mass destruction thing and,
you know,
having to lie to boldface to the American people. And Obama's been very careful not to put himself in a position where he has to tell a direct lie. You know, he lies, you know, every 5 minutes in the way that he talks by not, you know, always dancing around and never giving straight answers. But now on the Charlie Rose interview was a historic moment for Obama because he had to come out in public and actually lie and do the sort of George Bush thing or the Colin Powell thing, you know.
That's right.
Come out and push a totally inflated fake narrative and not reveal the true motivations of why the West are so hell-bent on regime change in Syria and has nothing to do with democracy, let me tell you.
Now, let's mull a little bit more here around Snowden and approach it from two different angles, because I think obviously beneath all of this, nonetheless, there is an important story. I always get weary in a way when you see this game being played in the big media, you know, circus out there, and but at the same time, it is an important story nonetheless of what's being highlighted and focused on, but. The question is how smart they are. I mean, the first inclination is obviously, you know, of course we should support people like Snowden because what he's exposing in that regard is true. The second layer to that is, okay, but is it being used now in some way, in different capacities to change things? Is this, if we think about people who are, for example, by the official government line, they listen to people like, Dick Cheney, and he speaks out about what a, you know, traitor he is, Snowden, and all the other, you know, puppet heads, they're talking about that too. Then for those people, Patrick, that will be like, yep, it just shows even more that we need more control, both over the internet, but, you know, how things are being communicated. Again, it goes back to the cybersecurity question, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also conflates the term espionage in the conversation with whistleblowing. So it is kind of an own goal in a way, because no matter what, how much support Ed Snowden has from the man on the street, in the public conversation, the term espionage has been attached to whistleblower. Okay, and already U.S. Representatives are coming out wanting to pass legislation. They put espionage charges on Snowden. And so anybody who's a whistleblower, I mean, Obama's got his insider profiling program. It's a story up on 21st Century Wire. I forgot the name of the program, but basically it was initiated way before this started. And what it does is it's designed to get federal employees to pay close attention to the behavior of their colleagues in government to deter any specific kind of whistleblowing activities. And this was put into play by, it's called the Insider Threat Program. And it was put into play after the Bradley Manning crisis. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it really put a chilling effect on whistleblowing way before the NSA stories come out here. And so a lot of the stuff's already in play. So, and again, it's really hard to put a fix on it. Yes, we should support Snowden in the, fundamentally in terms of any whistleblower. I will support them and say that it's a just cause. But if I was really controlling the whole game, if I wanted a leak to happen or I wanted a pressure release valve to open, I would want to do it at a time of my choosing and with the person who I've set up to do that for, that controlled opposition, if I was really in charge and I was playing the dark game. So it would make sense that it's a plan leak. So it's a problem reaction solution. In one way, you can look at it like the problem is NSA wiretapping, government surveillance, invasion of privacy, and the reaction is public outrage.
Yep.
How dare they? How can they do that? Oh, my goodness. And what's the solution? Well, could be that the solution is being voted on right now in Congress in the U.S., which is a national ID program. So this will be, yes, you'll have privacy and protection from being spied on if you have this national biometric ID card, which is basically like a car key to get online to surf. And it's also going to provide you for ID for purchases. And it's going to allow you to pass through various checkpoints, not just real checkpoints, but virtual checkpoints. Okay.
Yeah.
So this is the solution. So if you look at this Snowden affair in terms of Hegelian dialectic, you look at what's actually being pushed through Congress right now, which is the biometric national ID card. And it's so they could easily co-opt this ID card program saying that this is going to provide a layer of security and civil liberties for the user, but it's also going to help us in our fight against terrorism. So it's kind of a double entendre of sorts.
Yeah.
I'm looking at it in these sort of terms. When I look at a major event, I look at problem, reaction, solution. So the perfect example was right before Bilderberg. All of a sudden, right before Bilderberg, right before the big Google Big Ten event, Google was in the media being dragged through Parliament saying they've avoided paying millions in corporate tax. And how dare they not pay their fair share in Britain? And it's an outrage. So there is the problem, that the big corporations are using a myriad of shell companies and expensive litigation help from their armies of lawyers to avoid paying tax in any particular country. That's the problem. The reaction is public outrage, and the solution came not a week later, right before Bilderberg, and was discussed at the Google Big Ten event. The number one topic of discussion was a global corporate tax, global tax regime. So there you have problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah.
Right there. Played on the big stage, played in full view of the big media, with the major political players in play. But what's the end result going to be? Well, if there's a global corporate tax, the big corporations are still going to pay no tax. Okay, but if you have a global tax regime, you cannot have a tax in this world, on our planet, unless you have a government to administrate it. No one's talking about the global government that would be needed to administrate and distribute the revenues of this tax and the bureaucracy that will go with it. Okay, so that is the narrative of that story that I discovered, and of course I'm sure that was being talked about at Bilderberg, and definitely being talked about at the G8 in Ireland 2 weeks later.
And who is this, sorry to interrupt, Patrick, but who is this going to hurt the most? The small guys, the small businesses.
Yes.
Because again, it's about eradicating competition. These big companies are not about free enterprise and free market. It's about destroying everyone else and standing on their own in their monopoly. And they will nestle their way out of this anyway, as you said, with their lawyers, with their trickery, et cetera.
It's about this. The global taxation regime is a big story, okay? And it has to do with taxing transactions that occur across borders. Okay. Now the big players, either A, they can afford to pay a minor transaction tax, or B, they won't have to pay it at all because they have the power to lobby things in their favor. Who will pay their taxes on all this are the smaller businesses, the independent traders. If you look at the economic collapse that's happened over the last decade, and it has happened over the last 10 years, okay, it's not just from 2008. The thing that's kept most people afloat in terms of the middle class, and the educated middle class, from my personal experience and the people I've spoke to and traveling around to 20-odd different countries on this planet in the last few years, has been the internet, their ability to do a commerce over the internet. We're not talking about millions. We're talking about hundreds and thousands. That has been able to keep people's food on the table and allow them to get by when the real economy, the Main Street economy, has been decimated for various reasons that we won't go into. But if you take away the internet and the e-business for the small to medium-sized trader, basically, that means I will have to go in to the government dole office and basically register my life as a slave of the state and queue up every 2 weeks to get your little bit of money, and you need the government to pay your rent. And I know so many people that have avoided this because of the small amount of business they've been doing online. Now, the people who are in charge and in the social engineers see this, and this disgusts them. They think it's the most vulgar thing imaginable, and they want to shut it down, or they want to price you out of being able to do that business by adding regulation or adding tax that only the big players can do. So again, it's the trickle up capital, movement of capital upwards to create monopolies. Already the digital monopolies are in place. We already have PayPal, we have Facebook, we have Google, we have the major digital monopolies are in place. The markets are a huge amount of market share. Amazon, I mean, for what they do, I mean, ridiculous. If it was on the Main Street level, having an 80 or 90% market share, I mean, that would be antitrust territory, monopoly territory, Rockefeller territory. So those Rockefellers are being created now. The Rockefellers of our generation are being created in the digital world right now. Yeah. And those monopolies will stay in those hands of those people for many, many years to come. And the only thing that we have is our freedom of choice in a free market. And there used to be an egalitarian promise that the internet held for people. When it first came on the scene, there was a lot of positivity about, oh, wow, this is really a level playing field, right? It's a fantastic thing. And there's so much choice available, and the cream rises to the top, and you know, there's people going to go over here to this information here, this blog, because it's the best one on the street. And now that all the big blogs have been corporatized, and they're trying to regulate blogging in countries like the UK, and on the commercial side, which is a really important side, again, this global taxation regime coming in slowly, and the financial regulation over commerce done over borders on the internet. Yeah. And that's the next big point, contention point I see coming.
And, I mean, this is the discussion about the Bilderbergs, you know, the taxes. There's nothing new, really. There's been the Tobin tax has been on, you know, on the wall before. And now there's another thing as well, and I think it's primarily in the U.S., but it's called the Marketplace Fairness Act. And, again, here we go with the fairness, you know, bullshit, because this is how they're selling it to you. It's basically an internet sales tax, which, again, And this is fairly new to me. I just kind of got my eyes open to this. Lana alerted me to this the other day, and I haven't read all the details about it yet, but in so far in the critiques I've read about it, it's again one thing that actually, I mean, Amazon is actually pushing to get this through, because again, it benefits them because it's taking out the competition. It's hurting the small companies the most, and it demands this incredibly complex infrastructure basically on collecting all of this, and then, you know, basically the small companies have to do all the work for the different states and ultimately the government out there. So there's a number of these traps that they're, you know, trying to sell us, and it comes under this name of, like, fairness or, you know, equality and stuff like that. So they're smart. I know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly where it's going, and you can see it's happening right before your eyes. if you're paying attention anyway, you can see this happening. Very, very important, you know, that the internet, the free internet, the free wild west of the internet and all the brilliant aspects that made it so popular today, are really on its, built on the shoulders of all the independents, okay? Not the corporations. Yeah. Not the big monsters.
I mean, they were on their late, Patrick. They were latecomers to the scene.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon didn't turn a profit for years and years and years. It stuck in there, you know, well done for sticking in there with all that money they sunk into it. But now they have a monopoly online, a global monopoly for sellers. And it's definitely transformed the business playing field, and it's also transformed society and our culture in many different ways.
Gotta get off Amazon. Gotta get on there, off there quick, you know? Yeah. Hey, Patrick, why don't we take a short little break here at this point, and then we'll continue talking more about this internet censorship, tying in the bigger agenda of what's been going on at the Bilderberg. We can definitely return a little bit more if there's anything else leaving out on Snowden and the general environment as well of the whistleblowers and how this has been kind of created a new category of, well, it's a whole subject, really, but it's managed to transform the minds and the hearts of the people, and I think to a certain degree for good, because it does bring awareness. And then what we've been questioning is, but is it far enough and all that? So we'll talk more about that. But please, Patrick, give us your details about the website, 21st Century Wire. Give us out any other details in terms of if you have anything available on the website or videos or anything like that, Patrick.
Yeah, 21stcenturywire.com is our website. And there's a lot of good stories. We've broken a lot of great stories this year, and all the major events we've been on to it really hot. And I've got a couple of volunteer writers who work with me, and we've just been very good at focusing on major events. So the content is there on the Snowden affair right now, as it was on the Boston bombing before and any other big event. And on a YouTube channel, 21st Century Wire TV on YouTube, I've just released loads of new videos, and there'll be more coming out this week, which are shows that aired, that I filmed and aired in the UK earlier in the year, which are really interesting, with guests like David Icke and Gerard Williams and Gilad Atzmon and lots of great characters.
Excellent. Very good. 21stcenturywire.com. Check out the website. Head on over there. There's some great stories coming out, so add it to your favorites or your RSS feed, what have you. All right, we'll take a short break here at this point. We'll be right back with more, so stay with us.
Hey, everybody.
Everybody.
All around the world. Every boy and girl. Take a lesson from me. You look like a fool. But baby, I don't mind criticism, because we're doing it every day in school. Come along with me, see how much fun it can be.
In the second hour, we are going to continue to talk about surveillance, PRISM, and the larger NSA agenda. We'll also discuss Michael Hastings, the 33-year-old journalist who crashed with his car last week in L.A. Most likely, his car was hacked, and consequently, he was taken out, of course, possibly due to upcoming stories he was working on. Just an incredible story. More with Patrick Henningsen is coming up in the second hour. Just want to let you know that we have next on Red Ice Radio Alan Epidessa Green, Douglas Bowles, and Bill Klaus on the Sync Book Volume 2. After this, we have Stefan Kinsella, Stephen Mailer, and many more. Go to redicemembers.com. I urge everyone who enjoys our program to sign up for a membership and help us as we are taking Red Ice to the next level, providing you with more productions, more content, and specifically when it comes to more regular video updates from Red Ice and accompanying analysis. Thank you for your support. Hour 2 is coming up right now. Thank you for listening.